Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we choose an important new book in the broader field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. In her landmark new book, Leaving Iberia, Islamic Law and Christian Conquest in Northwest Africa, Jocelyn Hendrickson launches a searingly brilliant legal history centered on the question of how medieval and early modern Muslim jurists in Iberia and North Africa wrestled with various thorny questions of living under or migrating away from non-Muslim political sovereignty. This book combines meticulous social and political history with nimble and accessible readings of a vast range of sources from the Maliki School of Law. What emerges from this exercise is a picture of the Maliki legal tradition in particular, and Islamic law more broadly, that is unavailable for predictable readings, is enormously interesting, and deliciously complex. This lucid book should also be a delight to teach in various graduate and upper-level undergraduate courses. Here now is my conversation with Professor Jocelyn Hendrickson. Hello, Josie. Welcome to the New Books Network. It is a real pleasure to have you on our show and a real privilege to learn so much from your splendid new book, which is an incredibly layered examination of a number of fascinating and important texts. It really is legal history at its best in many ways. So looking forward to this conversation. Josie, we have a tradition on the New Books Network that our first question is always biographical. So I was wondering if you could share a bit with our listeners your journey, how you became a scholar of Islam.
Sure. And first of all, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's a real honor. And thank you so much for taking the time to read through the book. My interest in religion as a subjective study, not just Islam, but religion broadly, I think started quite early. I grew up on an island near Seattle and went through a fantastic public school system that introduced students to different religious traditions very early on. They had a major field trip to religious sites of worship in middle school and paid real attention to the history of religions in high school. I had grown up part Lutheran and part hippie, meaning very pluralist. And so even with that little bit of diversity, by my senior year in high school, I was quite curious about religious diversity and bothered by Christian hegemony in the United States. And I remember writing a senior honors thesis for my humanities seminar in high school on the impossibility of a unified world religion. Despite that promising start, though, I started practical. I went to the University of Washington as a biology major and planned to be a geneticist. But once I started taking religion courses, I really just turned toward that. I started with a broad survey of Eastern religions and was just completely fascinated. And I knew right away, that's what I want to do. And then the next semester, I took Western religions. And I immediately knew that that was what I wanted to study. So I declared my major in what's still called comparative religion at the University of Washington. And I will always be grateful to my undergraduate program for what happened next, which is that it was immediately pressed upon me that language study is absolutely imperative and time-consuming. To graduate with the comparative religion degree, we needed 2 years of a language, but to get honors, which I wanted to do, I would need 3 years of a scriptural language. So that meant Hebrew or Sanskrit or Pali or Arabic or the like, you know, a language of scripture. And I had only at that point taken these big surveys of world religions. So I really wasn't in a position to make an informed decision as to what religion I most wanted to study. What I chose was Arabic. I don't really know why, but I chose Arabic. And that meant that I was studying Islam. And I kept using Arabic. I took 5 years to finish my bachelor's because I spent one full year in Cairo studying nothing but Arabic. And after graduation, I went back to Cairo for another full year of Arabic through the CASA program. And by that point, I was pretty sure I wanted to do a PhD in Islamic studies. But I had a bit of a detour. I had a fellowship to spend a year in Beirut studying religion and conflict. But conflict intervened. The terrorist attacks of September 11th were that year. And my sponsor helped reroute me to Northern Ireland instead of Beirut, where I was able to do a master's in peace and conflict studies. I also spent a year working in a law firm and applying to law schools. I was very tempted by law school, but especially by the joint JD PhD program in law and religion at Emory University. There's really nothing like it. But ultimately, I turned down some very shiny law school admissions, including a full ride to Emory's law school, and I chose just, in quotes, just the PhD. But these various interests came together very nicely in my graduate training at Emory, and the dissertation research I was able to pursue in Islamic legal texts really brought all those interests together.
Terrific. So I thought maybe with this particular book, it might be useful for the listeners to hear you sort of to begin by setting the stage a bit. The book is titled Leaving Iberia. I was thinking maybe it would be useful to talk a bit about the geographical context, the historical sort of context, and the central question, the legal question that these jurists that you study are wrestling with. And maybe I know you deal with a number of different actors, but maybe if you could just name maybe two or three most central to the narrative, and then we'll get more into their thought and other complexities in a moment. But maybe if you could just set the stage a bit, the key question, the historical context, the geographical context, and the main actors.
Okay. So my book examines Islamic legal responses to Muslims living under Christian rule in Iberia and North Africa in the late 15th and early 16th centuries. That's a lot. I think it'll help a little to set the stage to talk a bit about my research process and how I came to those specifics. So while a lot had been written about the status of non-Muslims under Muslim law, when I first started this project long, long ago, I was interested in the reverse. I wanted to know what Islamic legal sources had to say about the status of Muslims living under non-Muslim law. And I very quickly found that all arrows pointed toward the Iberian Peninsula. The fall of Al-Andalus, also known as the Christian Reconquest of Iberia, is often described as a turning point in Islamic history when some of the first substantial Muslim populations fell under permanent Christian rule. Muslims had found themselves under non-Muslim rule in other parts of the world. The Levant during the Crusades is a good example. But those other historical cases involved smaller populations, or they were temporary, and they didn't leave behind a legal discourse grappling with this predicament of Muslim subjection to Christian rule. In Iberia, we did find a very well-established Muslim population that had ruled parts of the peninsula for nearly 800 years, from 711, when Muslim armies first crossed from North Africa to Iberia, up until the 1492 surrender of Granada, which was the last Muslim kingdom in Iberia. So when Christian kingdoms in Iberia conquered more and more Muslim territory beginning in the 11th century, large populations of Muslims were brought under permanent Christian rule for the first time. So this really is a turning point. From that point, for nearly 400 years, many Iberian Muslims lived as mudéjars, which is the term for Muslims living under Christian rule as Muslims. That is, mudéjars were allowed to practice Islam, even if they were subject to some restrictions that varied by region. Beginning in 1500, Muslims were forcibly converted to Christianity, first in Granada and then in the remainder of the peninsula. And that population, known as Moriscos, are generally considered to be clandestine Muslims or crypto Muslims, they're sometimes called, who were forced to act as Christians externally, but who maintained their Muslim identity in secret. And the Moriscos were later expelled from Spain in the early 17th century. So this centuries-long process of Christian conquests in Iberia posed a number of difficult new legal questions for Muslim jurists. The most basic was just the very permissibility of Muslim residents under non-Muslim rule. Was it legitimate for Muslims to remain in their homes and become Christian subjects? Or were they obligated to emigrate to some Muslim-ruled territory? And if they stayed, what would that mean? Was it possible to live a truly Muslim life without Muslim rule? The advent of these questions at this historical juncture was all the more interesting because jurists had so little precedent to rely on in trying to answer them. During the formative centuries of Islamic law, when the various schools of law cohered around certain doctrines that they attributed to their founders or earliest authorities, the Islamic Empire had always been expanding. So Muslims were simply assumed to live under Muslim law. And these later jurists at the time of the reconquest were supposed to ground their legal positions in existing school doctrine, but the issue of Muslims living under permanent Christian rule had simply not arisen. So how would they be able to answer these questions, these questions of such vital import for the Muslims of an entire region? So far, this is the interesting problem that quite a number of scholars before me were attracted to. And when I came to this subject, quite a lot had already been written on this topic of Islamic legal responses to the reconquest and the implications of this major event for both Christian-Muslim relations and for Islamic law. But what surprised me was that this existing literature only treated a handful of Islamic legal opinions or fatwas. So not only were there very few texts under discussion, but the literature focused overwhelmingly on opinions by only two jurists. And here I'm finally naming names. So the chief mufti of Fez was one of them, Ahmed al-Bancharisi. And in 1491, he issued a pair of fatwas asserting that conquered Iberian Muslims have an obligation to emigrate to Muslim territory. And the second guy, in addition to Wancharisi, is al-Wahrani, or the so-called Mufti of Oran, who in 1504 advised Granada and Moriscos as to how they could practice Islam in secret. And to many observers, these two jurist rulings presented a fascinating tension. Wancharisi was characterized as using strict interpretation of Islamic law to condemn those Muslims who remained in Iberia, while Wahrani was seen as far more flexible, creative, and sympathetic to their plight. And when I started out, I was fascinated by this tension between Wancharisi and Wahrani, but I was also convinced that I would be able to find more texts to bring into this conversation. And I'm sharing a bit of this research trajectory because I think it reveals deeply entrenched some of our scholarly assumptions are, and how disciplinary boundaries, national boundaries, all kinds of boundaries can constrain our thinking in ways we don't really realize. So when I set out to find more texts, I was looking for fatwas issued in the Mudéjar period, that period from roughly the 12th to 15th centuries. And I was convinced that a thorough search of published and manuscript fatwa collections in North Africa would add at least half a dozen texts to this conversation. So I spent a year and a half searching through every published Maliki fatwa collection I could find, as well as the manuscript libraries of Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, Egypt, and Spain. And this journey resulted in my publishing a lovely guide to Arabic manuscript libraries, but I was not finding any substantial new texts, and people were starting to tell me, you know, maybe this has already been done, which is the last thing you want to hear, right? So when I sat down to produce a translation of Wantrisi's fatwas, I finally realized that I'd been looking in the wrong direction, both geographically and temporally. And I can say more about that epiphany moment later, but I essentially decided that Wantrisi was only ostensibly addressing this obligation of Iberian Muslims to emigrate in his famous fatwas. And what he was really concerned with was Portuguese occupation in Morocco itself, which I had sort of barely heard of. It was not something anybody was talking about. So I realized that Muslims living under Christian authority was a pressing concern in Morocco itself, one that first arose with Portugal's 1415 capture of Ceuta, one of Morocco's Mediterranean ports that now belongs to Spain. So I turned my attention toward Portuguese and Spanish holdings in 15th and century Morocco, not toward the earlier Mudéjar period in Iberia. And that's when I found quite a number of Muslim legal responses to these Iberian conquests in North Africa. These opinions are preserved in a 17th century compilation of fatwas collected by a Moroccan jurist named Zayati, entitled Al-Jawahir al-Mukhtar, or Selected Jewels. So what I do in the book is introduce this Portuguese-focused body of legal opinions, and then revisit and reinterpret the fatwas by Wantrisi and Wahrani in the light of that material. So all of these opinions were issued in a roughly 25-year period, and I go through them chronologically, giving part one to the fatwas preserved by Zayati, most of which are in the 1480s and 1490s. Part two revisits Wantrisi, his two famous 1491 fatwas, and part three revisits Wahrani's 1504 fatwa. And then I take these three medieval case studies and move to the colonial period in part four of the book, which I use to examine Islamic legal responses to French colonization in Algeria and Mauritania, but also use those cases as a way to interrogate the disparate fates of all of the fatwas from the first three cases.
Wonderful. So, you know, one of the major conceptual interventions of this book that you signal quite early on is that you're trying to present a new kind of theorization of the fatwa itself as a genre in terms of its form, its purpose, its transmission, the work that it does, you know, intellectually, socially, etc. So could you tell a bit and share with our listeners a bit, you know, what is the sort of new theorization of fatwa that you try to offer here? And how does that interrupt some conventional understandings or wisdom around the genre of the fatwa?
So I mentioned this tension between how scholars have seen Wantrisi's fatwas obligating immigration versus how they have viewed Wahrani's advice to the Moriscos. And these two characterizations actually capture very well two trends in Islamic legal historiography, both of which I move away from, and I'll explain that in a second. The first trend can be thought of as the closing of the gate of ijtihad theory. So according to this theory, Muslim jurists were stripped of their interpretive freedom after the 10th century, when the major law schools were consolidated. And after that, they were left unable to adapt to new realities. So Islamic law becomes outmoded and irrelevant to the changing needs of society. And for many scholars, Wantrisi epitomized this. His opinions represented this orthodox opinion within the Maliki school, one that he just unthinkingly, cruelly applied to Mudéjars because he was unable or unwilling to adapt law to their new realities. So he epitomizes medieval stagnancy for many commentators. And ironically, it's precisely fatwas as a legal genre that have also been the most called upon as evidence in the refutation of this medieval stagnancy, closing of the gate theory. Fatwas are this great question and answer genre of legal text that show us the kind of concerns that arose in particular historical moments. So unlike legal manuals that set a statement of school doctrine, for example, that articulates these rules meant to be good for all times and places, fatwas promise to show us the concerns that aren't adequately addressed by those manuals and might have prompted a new question. So they allow us to see the active work of jurists bringing their legal tradition to bear on these questions. So I agree with this latter approach in general, but in their efforts to use fatwas to refute this stagnancy theory, scholars have really focused on fatwas that explicitly address completely novel circumstances or that depart or deviate from some kind of established position. So that is, the most obvious cases of nonconformity or innovation are held up as evidence that medieval jurists continued to exert intellectual effort and juristic discretion. And the enthusiasm with which Wahrani's text has been met is a great example of that, because he doesn't mention emigration and he offers Morisco's practical advice. He is celebrated for coming up with an original solution that accommodated Muslim minorities. And many saw him as arguing directly against Wahrani's rigid orthodoxy. So what I argue is that we can find ample evidence for juristic discretion, even in fatwas that appear conservative or that appear to do nothing more than establish, apply an established doctrine to a recurring case. Medieval jurists, the so-called gate of ijtihad may not have closed, but medieval jurists did face pressure to avoid the appearance of exercising ijtihad. So jurists like Wahrani wanted, to the extent possible, to claim that their opinions were grounded in the school's authoritative early sources. I'll say more about what I see him doing later, but in short, the appearance of conformity to the past and continuity with received doctrine is often a strategic fiction, one that Wahrani works hard to maintain. So even in this case, this jurist, who's seen as the epitome of rigid, stagnant orthodoxy, is actually exercising considerable discretion and manipulating past precedents to serve his purposes. So, and more broadly, I don't take fatwas at face value as straightforward or transparent reflections of reality and of the intentions of their authors. Legal texts are shaped by a variety of factors, including material constraints, political pressures, the parameters as to what is acceptable as a valid legal argument, and professional conventions. I read between the lines and interrogate the possible motives and constraints that shape a given fatwa. In other words, I read fatwas as strategically constructed narratives. And this may sound like a really obvious way to approach historical texts, but Islamic legal texts in particular have often been read without this kind of critical interrogation or nuance. And just as a final point here, a theme that encompasses the whole book is the idea that Islamic legal texts are in a realm of competing ideas, and we can try to identify concrete reasons why some opinions have greater resonance for later jurists than others do. So opinions like Wahrani's, they don't succeed in remaining authoritative because they're orthodox, a concept that seems particularly unsuited to describe any fatwa, which is an ad hoc, non-binding opinion. Instead, there's a range of factors that account for the success of any given opinion, including historical events and the dramatic appeal of a text.
Terrific. So in the first part of the book, you examine and analyze in great detail and with a lot of fascinating exploration the eight fatwas from what you just mentioned, Zayati's collection, Selected Jewels. That, of course, is regarding Muslims living under Portuguese authority in the Maghreb who have come under Christian rule. I know it will be impossible to talk in any sort of even briefly about all eight fatwas, but maybe you could select a couple or any representative fatwas from this selection to share with our listeners a bit. You know, what are the sort of major trends and differences that we see in these fatwas in this collection? And I also want to ask you made a point towards the end of this chapter that it's very important to bring this Maghribi context into view and not to assimilate this whole discussion around the much more well-known sort of Iberian context of, you know, Christian-Muslim relations and that unfolding narrative that people are more familiar with. Tell us a bit more about why that is very important to you, the Maghribi context and identity of many of these scholars who are represented in the Selected Jewels Fatwa Compendium.
So don't worry, I won't take you through all 8 opinions, but I want to start with why this is important. These fatwas preserved by Zayati help overturn a very Eurocentric focus in our understanding of Iberian-Muslim relations in the 15th century. They challenge a perception of Iberian exceptionalism. They disrupt a Christian triumphalist narrative regarding the Reconquest. And they show Islamic legal texts acting as a form of indigenous resistance to European empire in the 15th century, which I understand from others is something we don't really have much of in other parts of the world. So I've mentioned Iberia has received nearly all of the scholarly attention that has been devoted to the issue of Islamic legal responses to Muslims living under Christian rule. The story of Portuguese conquest in North Africa has been sorely neglected in general, and the fact that this body of opinions has been overlooked is a glaring omission given the fascination and interest scholars have shown in this legal issue. So these opinions related to the Portuguese in North Africa are not just a similar case to Iberia, but happening somewhere else. They're integrally connected to the peoples and events in Iberia. These are Iberian conquerors who arrived in the Maghreb, occupied most of Morocco's Mediterranean and Atlantic ports, and elicited responses that drew on the same legal categories and precedents that were applied in the fatwas directly related to Iberia. So I'll give just a few examples of what these fatwas are like, and then come back to these broader points. A few of the fatwas respond to multi-part questions that ask the status of Muslims, about the status of Muslims who live in Christian-controlled territory or near to it. The questions ask about the legal status of Muslims who fall into set categories. For example, those who merely reside under Christian rule, those who trade with the Christians, those who pay them tribute, those who spy for them, and those who fight alongside the Christians against fellow Muslims. And there's one curious category of Muslims who fish with the enemy. And the jurists respond to each of these categories with some variation. For example, there's an Ibn Barthal who states that those Muslims who merely reside under Christian rule are disobedient to God. They lose their ability to testify or to lead prayer, but as Muslims, their lives and property remain inviolable. As for those who spy for the enemy, Ibn Barthal states that the commonly accepted view is that spies should be killed. As it turns out that Watrisi is one of the three jurists presented with a very similar typology. This suggests that a few jurists in Fez were all given the same questions and quite possibly shared their answers with one another. Based on the biographical information that we have for these jurists and some other contextual clues, they were likely writing in the late 1480s. So this is actually well after that first Portuguese conquest of Ceuta in 1415, but it responds possibly quite directly to three other events. First, Portugal's dramatic conquests in 1471 of both Asila and Tangier, both in northern Morocco, responds to a peace treaty signed by the new Wattasid ruler, Mohammed al-Sheikh, with Portugal, and responds to a number of treaties signed with Portugal by port cities on Morocco's southern Atlantic coast. Wancharisi's contribution to this particular discourse is called his Berber fatwa, because the question asks him about a group of Berbers who failed to relocate when their territory became subject to Christian rule. And this fatwa is particularly important because Wancharisi must have written it prior to composing his two more famous fatwas, ostensibly concerned with Al-Andalus. The Berber fatwa reads like a rough draft for Esnel Matajir and the Mardaya fatwa. the fact that Wangechi uses the same legal arguments in both opinions, again, shows that he considered these cases to present the same basic legal problem, just of Muslim submission to Christian rule. So there's a sameness here. And there's also a difference that are both important. The sameness indicates the existence of a shared legal discourse on Muslims in both Iberia and North Africa. And this challenges the perceived exceptionalism of the Iberian Muslim predicament. So I'll come back to differences in a minute, but the history of Islam and Muslims in Iberia, it is fascinating. I teach a course on medieval Iberia. I love it. There is much about this history that is unique. For example, the size and longevity of a Muslim population in Europe, the intermingling of Jews, Christians, and Muslims, the cultural impact of Muslims on their Christian conquerors. There are aspects of medieval Iberia that are unique, but that doesn't make Iberia's Muslims uniquely worthy of study. What I'm calling for is that we not be blinded by the light of Iberia, such that we neglect the experiences and voices of North African Muslims. And this is probably a good time to explain the title of the book, Leaving Iberia, Islamic Law and Christian Conquest in Northwest Africa. So by leaving Iberia, I mean three things. The first is a reference to the emigration of Muslims away from Iberia toward North Africa, in response to all kinds of pressures, including the obligation to emigrate. Second, it's a reference to the Christian Iberian conquerors who likewise left Iberia to pursue reconquest and crusade in North Africa. And third is my call to shift some of our scholarly focus away from Iberia and toward North Africa, especially as pertains to Muslims grappling with Christian conquest. And this second meaning is the one that's invoked on the book's cover. Most books on Islamic law have a cover image of an Arabic manuscript, and that also would have been apt, but I chose a detail from the Pastrana tapestries, a set of four enormous tapestries that King Afonso of Portugal commissioned to commemorate his twin victories over Asila and Tangier in 1471. The detail is a boat full of Portuguese soldiers who are besieging Asila. And in choosing that image, I hope to underscore the importance of the Portuguese conquests in North Africa for both Iberians and Maghrebis, or North Africans, and also to help challenge the notion that the so-called Christian reconquest was always considered a recovery of the Iberian Peninsula only, and that it ended in 1492 with a clear Christian victory. As others have shown, both Portugal and Castile originally hoped for great conquests in Africa, and they justified those conquests on the basis of the same notions of reconquista and jihad current in the peninsula itself. Only once these North African ventures were defeated or abandoned did the reconquest assume the seemingly natural borders of the Iberian Peninsula and end in 1492. So one last point here, to pick up on the thread from earlier, the differences between these fatwas preserved by Zayati and those pertaining to Iberia are as important as the similarities. The biggest difference is that the Zayati ones are clearly informed by an active state of war between various North African groups and the Portuguese. Jihad to recover territory is mentioned as a real and praiseworthy activity. And in two of the cases, Muslims aiding the enemy are accused of apostasy, not just sin. These fatwas are messier and more nuanced than the Andalusi ones, but they're also often much harsher. They show jurists actively resisting foreign domination by trying to persuade their fellow Muslims to refuse collaboration with the enemy. And in two cases, the jurists appear to critique the Watassid ruler for inaction and instead sanction irregular warfare against Portugal. And in all cases, there's a sense of urgency that these opinions mattered for real life and were issued in a state of urgency. For example, Ibn Bartal was sent a repeat question, and he protests in one of the fatwas. He said, "I already answered your question, but you didn't get it, and you sent it again." So it's kind of wonderful to see that real life impact, the expectation of these legal opinions aren't just sitting in a text somewhere. They actually meant something in real life to people.
Well, next, let's turn to one of the major protagonists of this book, among many others, but you especially spend a lot of time analyzing Alwan Sharisi's two major texts, Asna al-Matajid that you just mentioned and the Marbella Fatwa. I wanted to actually ask you, after your analysis of these two fatwas, especially Asna al-Matajir, you make the point that you're trying to complicate his image of, you know, being sort of the inflexible or the doctrinaire kind of jurist who had an unchanging view of the law as fixed, and saw legal precedent also in this kind of very stringent ways, and you try to actually make the argument very convincingly that in fact this is a construction on his part. He constructs that view of the legal past that actually then works for his own normative agenda. So I was wondering if you could speak about that argument, and do that by talking a bit about the key themes that come up in these two fatwas and what kinds of texts they are.
So you just summarized it really well. Thank you. I think what I'll do is I want to come back to that epiphany I mentioned a bit ago that really changed my perspective on these two fatwas and how to read them. The question components of these two texts are quite memorable and really provide the key to the kinds of manipulations and strategies that I see Wantrisi pursuing to realize that normative agenda. So in the question component to Asna al-Matajir, Wantrisi is asked about a group of Andalusi Muslims who had abandoned their homes, property, and former lives. They're described as fleeing with their religion and children, managing to escape infidel rule, and resettling in the land of Islam somewhere in the Maghrib. But unfortunately, after completing their hijra, these Andalusi Muslims were unable to find any security or prosperity in the Maghrib. They regretted their immigration. They began to openly curse the Maghrib, and they expressed a desire to return to Castile, like, by any means possible. Wantrisi is asked to clarify whether or not the obligation to emigrate is contingent on material comfort, which is clearly a rhetorical question. But he's also asked what punishment these Andalusis deserve for their offenses. In the dominant reading of this question, that is in the literature before me, for Asna al-Matajir, this description of the Mudéjars has evoked a lot of sympathy for the tremendous difficulties facing them and facing all Mudéjars. And most scholars analyzing the text were interested in the social and political realities of Muslim life under Christian rule. So they tended to describe Al-Wantrisi and his fatwas as extremely severe and of grave consequence for the Mudéjars, because he didn't permit any kind of residence other than just complete inability. And these immigrants were seen as a pious and beleaguered group who, in some accounts, approached Al-Wantrisi themselves, asking him to sanction their return home to Castile. There's another assumption that Wantrisi delivered his severe condemnation directly to the Andalusis in question, and also that they took the answers home and circulated them among Iberian Muslims. The fatwas are then presumed to have encouraged immigration by those Muslims who were able to leave, namely the elites, and that in turn left the poor defenseless and branded all Mudéjars who remained as sinners and traitors. A couple early authors even blamed Al-Wantrisi himself because of this dynamic of drawing away the elites and leaving the poor, who were then susceptible to apostasy and control. They blamed Al-Wantrisi for the downfall of Spanish Islam. Now, instead of reading this question with this aim of understanding Mudéjars better, I approached the text from an Islamic legal perspective, asking first, okay, who is posing this question? Who is the audience, right? What is the mandate for the answer? And as it turns out, another jurist located somewhere in the Maghrib named Ibn Khatiyah is the questioner. And what that means is that the immediate audience for Wantrisi's response was this other jurist, not the emigrants. And he was asking about offenses committed in the Maghrib, chief among them fitna, or the disruption of the public order that was would result from other Maghribis hearing these Andalusis in the Maghrib insulting the Maghrib, mocking the obligation to emigrate and claiming that Christian rule is far preferable to Muslim rule. So Montresi presents a long response building the case for obligatory immigration based on numerous Quranic verses enjoining emigration and prohibiting alliances with unbelievers. He includes a few hadiths concerning immigration, and he relies quite a bit on one specific legal precedent that I'll come back to. When he arrives at the specific punishments that these Andalusis deserve, his answer is striking. He recommends an exemplary punishment. And in looking at all these clues about what's going on in the Maghrib, I realized that these unhappy Andalusian immigrants had probably landed in court in Morocco. And a jurist associated with that court case must have written to Montresi for an opinion from the capital. I don't think these Andalusian immigrants saw the fatwa. I don't think there's any evidence that this text circulated in Iberia or was read by any Mudejars. So beyond his questioner, Montresi was writing for a large audience, but that audience was the wider professional legal community that would read the Ma'yar, which is his massive 12-volume fatwa compilation, for which Montresi is actually primarily known. And he chose to include Esnaul Muntajir and the Marbeya fatwa in that compilation, but he excluded all the opinions preserved by Zayati that relate to Portuguese occupation in the Maghrib, even his own Berber fatwa. So what I argue is that Montresi decided to write one thorough, compelling, definitive statement on the obligation to emigrate, primarily because it was a pressing matter of security and territorial integrity in the Maghrib in his time. He was in a unique position as compiler of the Ma'yar to decide which fatwas would receive a broad circulation. He couldn't know it for sure at the time, but his compilation did, in fact, go on to be copied extensively and become a standard Maliki reference work. So he could have composed this one compelling statement that he wanted to preserve and circulate in the context of his Berber fatwa, or in the context of Ibn Qutiyya's questions about the Andalusian immigrants and the man from Marbella. And I argue that Montresi chose the latter as the more compelling frame. He's constructing this argument, right? So when Montresi composed these ostensibly Andalusian fatwas, the fall of Muslim Iberia had been underway for over four centuries and was within months of completion. The fate of Iberia's Muslims would have provided a more concrete historical precedent than the still unfolding and much more complicated situation in Morocco. And this tragedy would also have served as a warning for Montresi's present Maghribi audience of the consequences of complacency in the face of unchecked Christian advances. So I read between the lines and see Esnaul Muntajir, in which a Maghribi jurist writes for a Maghribi audience about offenses taking place in the Maghrib, as a powerful but veiled commentary on the foreign occupation of the Maghrib in Montresi's time. Aside from the power of Al-Andalus as a tragic precedent, framing his commentary in this way had a few other advantages. It allowed Montresi to blame Andalusis instead of Maghribis for misdeeds. It allowed him to set aside his more overt political critique of Wattasid in action that had appeared in his Berber fatwa. It allowed him to leave readers with quite memorable human stories and allowed him to present very simple cases in which Muslims who are capable of emigrating are required to do so. He doesn't deal with anything more complicated than capable Muslims. In the Marbella fatwa, just briefly, Montresi is asked about a man who had remained in that city to look for his brother. This man becomes an invaluable spokesperson for the community and helps them negotiate with Christian authorities. The question is whether or not this man can remain for the purpose of helping others. But the question also describes this man and all those around him as capable of emigration. So again, Montresi avoids any terribly difficult questions and again prescribes emigration, refuting the idea that seemingly more meritorious acts could be a reason not to emigrate. And if we turn to Juan Tracy's answers, he engages in quite a few distinct strategies to convince readers of the obligation to emigrate under nearly all circumstances aside from immobility. And I see all of these strategies as instances of juristic discretion that require originality and skill, legal dexterity, but that ultimately are in the service of an opinion that's meant to uphold what we might consider as a conservative rather than an accommodating opinion. And I'll just mention a couple of these strategies. The first is unacknowledged borrowing, or what today we would call plagiarism in modern terms. Thanks to the work of other scholars, we know that Juan Tracy borrowed extensive material from an earlier Andalusian jurist named Ibn Rabia. And Juan Tracy distributed parts of Ibn Rabia's fatwa as the answers to both Esnaul-Matajr and the Marbella fatwa, along with much of his own material taken from the Berber fatwa or composed anew for this new composition. Normally, jurists cite their sources, but failing to do so helps Juan Tracy build his case. It bolsters his own authority, because he looks like the author of all this. And more importantly, he avoids having to admit that Ibn Rabia wrote his text in response to a very particular problem, which was the considered opinion presented to him of another jurist who advocated the permissibility of remaining under Muslim rule. And that other jurist had a number of seemingly good reasons. And Juan Tracy takes those arguments and responds to them all, but doesn't acknowledge that there was ever a jurist making those claims. And by erasing that circumstance, by virtue of not citing Ibn Rabia at all, Juan Tracy manages to claim a scholarly consensus against residence under Christian rule, a consensus that clearly didn't really exist, right? Because we know at least this one other jurist was making these arguments. So Juan Tracy can't really risk revealing the context that led to Ibn Rabia's fatwa. He suppresses that fatwa in order to preserve that claim of scholarly consensus. So that's one tactic. And I'll just mention one other strategy. Is Juan Tracy's attempt to make a new ruling look like a seamless continuation of an old ruling, grounded in the established doctrine of the Maliki school's earliest masters. The new ruling is that conquered Muslims must emigrate, right? And the old rule is that lone converts, that is, people living in infidel territory, Dar al-Harb, who convert to Islam, must emigrate to Muslim territory. They're not allowed to remain where they are, and their property is not given protection as inviolable until they bring it with them to Muslim territory. In plain logic, there are disparities between the case of a lone convert to Islam and the case of a whole community of Muslims whose territory is suddenly conquered by non-Muslims. But the first case, the lone convert, had been discussed and could be traced back to early authorities. So Juan Tracy expends considerable effort in equating these two cases. And that allows him to apply or claim that he's applying this well-established rule in Maliki doctrine to this case that he sees as simply another facet of this old case.
Well, next, let's turn to another text by Wahrani, which is oftentimes labeled the 1504 fatwa. And as you sort of mentioned in the book, that it's oftentimes presented as the other of Juan Tracy in terms of its sort of permissiveness, etc. And this, of course, was advice that he offered to the Moriscos. First of all, you show, in fact, in this chapter that this, in fact, is not a conventional fatwa, but a different kind of text. So I was wondering if you could speak a bit about what kind of text this was. And just generally, what kind of advice did he offer to the Moriscos in terms of their engagement with this non-Muslim sovereign authority?
So Wahrani's text is this really amazing, relatively short text meant for the Moriscos. Wahrani wrote it in 1504, which means that he would have been writing for the first Muslims who had been forcibly converted to Christianity in Granada. And what he does in this text is offer these Moriscos a list of strategies and advice that allow them to maintain a sense of adherence to Islamic practices like prayer and ablution while also making sure they don't get caught. So, for example, he states that they can use mere gestures to pray if they need to. They can consider swimming in the river to be their ablutions. And they don't need to worry about sinning. They won't sin if they're forced to do things like pray in church or drink wine, as long as their hearts remain firm in faith and they continue to believe and to know that these things would normally be prohibited if they could afford to not do them. This advice was clearly useful and meaningful to the Moriscos because they continued to copy this text, presumably at great risk, throughout the century-long Morisco period. We have three copies of Mohrani's text that were copied by Moriscos. The first one's in Arabic, and the next two are in Alhamiado, or Spanish written in a modified Arabic script. The last one of these three was copied in 1609, and that's the year in which the Edict of Expulsion was proclaimed. So it's clear they were copying it throughout that period. And for my purposes, there's three notable things about this text. First, it has always been known as the 1504 fatwa, but I argue that it's not actually a fatwa. And, you know, that's okay. Not everything has to be a fatwa. But I don't agree with the prevailing assumption that Moriscos sent Wahrani a question that we've now lost. Instead, I think Wahrani, who was working in Fez at the time, encountered a copy of a text known as the 1501 Morisco Appeal to the Ottoman Sultan. That's how it's known to us, right? In which the Moriscos described their plight. They had just had a rebellion put down and been forcibly converted, and they appealed to the Ottoman Sultan for diplomatic aid. And I think that appeal to the Ottoman Sultan came through Fez, and Wahrani saw it, and that is what prompted him to write actually an unsolicited letter of advice and send it to them just out of his own concern. The second point is that this text is not really comparable to Matrisi's fatwas, even though much has been made of contrasting them with one another. Matrisi was writing about the obligation to emigrate for Muslims who were capable of doing so. And he composed the two-part technical argumentative treatise full of proof texts and meant for a legal professional audience. Wahrani wrote a heartfelt letter of guidance and advice meant for a lay Morisco audience. It contains next to no proof text and does not mention emigration because it's directed at an audience clearly incapable and exempt from that obligation. And finally, the fates of these two juris fatwas could not have been more different. Wahrani's text is the only one of the opinions I have mentioned so far that we know to have circulated in Iberia, but it's never again mentioned in Islamic legal texts related to hijra or immigration, and seems to have no appreciable impact on the development of Maliki legal thought on this issue. By contrast, Matrisi's Essen al-Matajr and the Marbella fatwa enjoyed the opposite fate. They can't be shown to have circulated in Iberia, but they succeeded in having a major impact on Maliki legal thought. They became the precedents of record on the issue of Muslim submission to non-Muslim rule. It's shown when we look at the colonial cases.
Towards the end of this book, in the third part, you also talk about what one might call the afterlives of these texts coming from the North African and Iberian context in the 15th and 16th centuries by looking at these really fascinating texts coming out of 19th century Algeria and Mauritania, confronted with a different colonial situation, the French colonizers. And you show ways in which this legacy of people like, especially Juan Cherise, who sort of becomes canonized by this point, on this particular question of Muslims living under non-Muslim rule, how they rework and reconfigure this legacy or this corpus of texts. So as a broad question first, I was wondering if you could speak a bit about some major similarities and differences between these two contexts of Algeria and Mauritania in terms of how they engage and reconfigure the thought of Juan Cherise and Maliki law more broadly in terms of this particular question.
So these colonial cases are interesting because we get to hear both sides of the debate on the obligation to immigrate. And that's quite different from Juan Cherise's era. For the Mauritanian case, for example, we have quite a few fatwas and legal letters that support an obligation to emigrate, but just as many that support the opposite, the permissibility or even desirability of remaining under French rule. And in the Algerian case, we have quite a few opinions advocating emigration. And we only have, in that case, one fully extant opinion rejecting that view. But in the corpus, there's a lot of traces of other scholars who must have been defending the permissibility of remaining under French rule as well. So I think there's two fairly interesting things to note about the Algerian debate. One is the very personal nature of the debate. So in the fatwas preserved by Zayati, we get a lot of these dry typologies, like, you know, this category of Muslim does this, this category does that, they spy or they trade. But in Algeria, many of these jurists making these arguments are themselves faced with a choice of remaining in their homes and accepting French rule, accepting a post with the French, or emigrating. And we see some really awful personal attacks. We also see jurists changing their mind. In the Colifunda 1 text advocating immigration, there's a note marveling at the fact that this guy who's put some commentaries in the margin has lost his mind. You know, he advocates immigration. He quite severely attacks another jurist for all the things he does that, interestingly, mirror the things that Awantrisi talks about in the Marbella fatwa. And then that jurist who has made all these commentaries linking this opponent directly to the Marbella fatwa, he himself then goes and moves and accepts appointment under French rule. So this is something that's personally impacting the very people who are writing, which is quite different from the earlier cases. The second thing that I found really curious about the Algerian case is that it would seem to me of the three earlier cases, right, the three cases that these jurists could look back to, there's the Zayati fatwas that grappled directly with Christian invasion on Maghrebi soil. And there's the Wantrisi cases that cast everything in terms of these Andalusis. And then there's Wahrani, who's talking about being a secret Muslim. I thought, you know, why not look back to Zayati's cases? Why not see that direct connection with fatwas that are issued in a similar context, you know, a Christian invasion in North Africa? But that's not what they look back to. The Wantrisi fatwas become dominant. And I think one of the reasons for Algeria is that it really is, Wantrisi seemed to be right in a couple ways. He was right that the tragic fate of Al-Andalus would be seen as a conclusive precedent that made him look correct in his judgment. That historical fact validates his opinions for later Muslims. And he was also right, I think, in his strategy. His strategy of doing that paid off, flipping from what he could have written about, which was Portuguese occupation. He could have preserved the Berber fatwa and elaborated that instead, but he made a strategic choice to go with the Andalusi ones, and it seems to have worked, because they, you know, in one of the Algerian fatwas, we hear one of the jurists saying, you know, haven't these idiots heard the news of Al-Andalus? You know, this is what happens if you allow Christian rule. Islam, it's not just Muslims who come under Christian rule. Islam will become extinct. And for Mauritania, it's a very similar pattern. Wahrani is not mentioned. There's even less mention of Zayati and a lot of Wantrisi. but not quite as exclusive. The Mauritanian case moves away both geographically and temporally from that poignancy of the Andalusi example. There's a lot of new arguments. One of the most powerful arguments comes to be that, you know, European colonization is everywhere in Africa. There's nowhere to go and you can't fight it. So it's just unrealistic at this point to choose Hijra or Jihad, and submission is really the only answer. But the Andalusis are still there a little bit. There are some of those personal family dynamics too. There's a cousin, very memorable fatwa, in which a cousin is pleading with his cousin and he says, please don't be like those awful Andalusis who were mocking their Islamic obligations.
As a final substantive question on this book, towards the end of the book, there's a very fascinating discussion on one particular scholar from Mauritania, Muhammad al-Busadi, and his critique of Wantrisi and the sort of points of his critique. A very fascinating text, it seems. Could you speak a bit about some key points of his critique and what are some of the implications of this critique that you offered?
Yeah, I love this text. It's really long and complicated, and the chapter is complicated, but it's this fabulous text. Busadi is this really interesting figure who agrees with Montresi that immigration is necessary. Busadi emigrated. He left Mauritania within the first few years of French colonial presence there. But he argues that the property rights of Muslims who remain under French rule in Mauritania must be respected. So he's got this really interesting middle ground. It's a long treatise posed as a fatwa. And it's what he does is he completely refutes, he dismantles Montresi's analogy between those lone converts and the conquered Muslims that underpin basically Montresi's entire argument. Without that conflation of conquered Muslims, this new case to this case that's supposedly settled by scholarly consensus, the lone converts, without that conflation, Montresi doesn't have much of his legal argument is not unassailable, right? Like, there's this guy who comes along and just dismantles it, and he shows that... sorry. he refutes Wancherisi on his own grounds by using Maliki precedents only. He agrees that the same proof texts are valid, but claims that Wancherisi just doesn't have the legal reasoning right, and he presents an entirely different analogy that ends up showing that the property of these Mauritanians under French colonial rule needs to be respected. And it's just a fascinating document, but the big takeaway there for me is that Wancherisi doesn't succeed in making these opinions the predominant Maliki statement on this legal issue because his reasoning is seamless or watertight or because he's orthodox or right. It's because of this other constellation of factors that later jurists chose to treat his opinions as correct, and they kept having resonance for people. And it's just really great to see this that dismantling of his opinion by Busadi.
So as we're coming to the end of our time, Josie, I was wondering if you could share a bit with our listeners about what might be the next project you might think to do.
So there's a few. one thing is, I'll just say I'm still working on this book. And so is in case since there'll be an online companion to this book on the Harvard site. And I'm putting the finishing touches on a couple Arabic editions that'll go up there. And there'll also be a downloadable PDF of the book. So that is coming. Meanwhile, I'm finishing up an article-length project on Tqiya in colonial Mauritania, which is a bit of an offshoot from this. And there's a project on Wancherisi's treatise on reprehensible innovations from the 15th century.
Leaving Iberia, Islamic Law and Christian Conquest in Northwest Africa by Professor Jocelyn Hendrickson, published by Harvard University Press in 2021. Thank you so much, Josie, for coming on the show, for your generous time and for your really lucid and splendid answers to these questions, and really for generating and producing this incredible and incredibly rich and complex book that I'm sure will spark discussions and conversations among scholars from multiple fields of knowledge. So thank you so much. So this was my conversation with Professor Jocelyn Hendrickson about her wonderful new book, Leaving Iberia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. Until next time, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and even in 2022, keep listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.
Thank you.